Jamie and David made their way slowly along the first floor, carefully checking each room as they came to it. It hadn't taken them long to work out an efficient system. They'd stop and listen carefully at the door, while Alistair and Brennan kept a watchful eye on the corridor. Then David would ease the door open, Jamie would kick it in, and they'd both charge into the room, swords at the ready. Once they were sure the room was empty, they'd turn the place upside down, just in case there were any secret hiding places Jamie didn't know about. Then out into the corridor, and do the same with the next room, over and over again. The long run of empty rooms was starting to take its toll on their nerves, but Jamie and David stuck at it. Having to just stand and watch helplessly as the freak drained the life out of Greaves hardened their hearts till there was no room in either of them for anything but revenge.
I can't believe Greaves is dead. He's been with the McNeils for more than 20 years. He's always been here. He played with me when I was a child. He was a confidant, an advisor, when no one else could be bothered to listen.
Greaves had never been a warm man. There had always been something distant about him. But he was always there when Jamie needed him.
And now he is gone. Dead and gone. Like all the others. And there is no one left to tell me what to do for the best. I am the McNeil now. The family depends on me. My family and friends. I'll be damned if I let them down.
Alistair kept a careful watch on the empty corridor as Jamie and David ransacked another room.
That girl Isabel worries me. Why should she insist on sticking by her brother when it must have been obvious to her that he was the freak and her real brother was dead? Surely the freak couldn't be controlling her that completely. No. If he had that kind of control, that kind of power, he wouldn't have run in the first place. Could it be that Isabel saw something in Richard that proves he is still who he claims to be? No. Richard must be the freak. It's the only explanation that makes sense after all the lies I caught the man in. Isabel just didn't want to believe her brother was dead.
Alistair hefted his sword thoughtfully. He'd have to be careful she didn't get hurt when they finally cornered the freak and killed him. He glanced at Brennan, who was studying the darker shadows and alcoves with professional thoroughness. He looked solid and reliable, and somehow more alive than he'd ever seemed before. It was as though the man he'd once been woke and took over from the second-rate minstrel he'd become. Alistair felt a hell of a lot safer with this new Brennan to guard his back. Jamie and David meant well, but they had no real experience with blood and pain and sudden death. That was why he let them check out the rooms. Wherever the freak went to ground, it wouldn't be in any of the rooms. He was too clever for that. No, far more likely he'd be using one of the old secret passages or hidden bolt holes, waiting for a chance to jump out on his unsuspecting pursuers and pick them off one at a time while they were busy searching empty rooms.
When we find the freak, no mercy.
Hawk and Fisher sat side by side on the cold stone floor with their backs to the wall, as far away from the stairs as they could get. They'd been arguing for what seemed like hours, and they were still no nearer to agreeing on anything. There were just too many theories and too few facts. They were after two men, not one, and anything that fit one case inevitably didn't fit with the other. They finally fell silent, staring up and down the gloomy, curving corridor. They didn't dare light any lamps for fear of giving away their position, and the shadows all around seemed deep, menacing, and not a little mocking.
There has to be an answer here somewhere, but I'm damned if I can see it.
Oh, keep looking. We're running out of time. They'll be here soon. There must be something we're missing. Something so obvious we're looking right past it.
All right, let's try turning the problem on its head. Assume that all our assumptions so far are wrong. Where does that take us?
Right back where we started. We can't just throw everything out, Hawk.
Why not? Our assumptions aren't getting us anywhere. Start at the very beginning. We've been assuming the spy Fenris went to the Sorcerer Grimm for a complete shape change so that no one would be able to recognize him. That meant anyone who could prove they had the same appearance for the past 24 hours could be ruled out as a suspect. But what if the spy went to Grimm for a shape change earlier on and went back there to get his old shape back?
How the hell did we miss something that obvious?
Trying to do two jobs at once. This is the first real chance we've had to sit down and think things through since we got here.
That's true. But if Fenris didn't change his appearance, then that throws everything wide open again. He could be anyone. That shape change was the only way we had of separating Fenris out of the pack.
There's one other way. Dubois told us the spy's a member of the Quality. As I said at the time, why would one of the Quality want to be a spy? The usual incentives are politics and money, but most Quality don't give a damn about politics and already have more money than they can hope to spend in one lifetime. But one of our merry band here at Tower McNeil has money problems coming out of his ears. He's admitted he has huge gambling debts, and even more damning, he actually talked about starting a business venture, a gossip paper, on the grounds it might make him money. What respectable member of the Quality would dirty his hands with vulgar trade unless he was desperate to pay off his debts?
David. David Brooke. You're right, Hawk. It fits.
He couldn't go to his family or friends for the money without admitting he'd made a fool of himself, and his pride wouldn't allow him to do that. The moneylenders would want security he didn't have. He doesn't actually own anything solid until he inherits his estate on his father's death. He was hoping to marry money through Holly, but according to Duncan's will, all she gets is some jewelry and whatever allowance Jamie feels like granting her.
Of course! That's why he got so upset on her behalf at the will reading.
Right. Holly was his last chance. He must have known he couldn't depend on her, and that's why he took to spying. With so many of his family in the army and the diplomatic corps, he had opportunities to get all sorts of information. He's our spy, Isabel, no doubt about it.
Wait a minute. That's all very well, but it doesn't help us one damn bit with our current problem, which is how to identify the freak before the others get here. If we can't point a convincing finger at someone else, they'll kill us, or we'll have to kill them. If we end up having to kill a bunch of Quality, even in self-defense, that's the end of us in Haven. All the families in the city would declare vendetta against us, and the guard would withdraw our immunity rather than openly confront the Quality.
All right, don't panic. I'm working on it. I still think it's Alistair. He lied to us about the Red Marches, and he was very quick to condemn me as the freak. Perhaps he thought he could turn suspicion away from himself by accusing me.
He was pretty eager, wasn't he? And it's interesting that no one seems to have actually remember him being banished from Tower McNeil in the first place. He had to have been a contemporary of Duncan's, so how is it Katrina had never even heard of him?
Because Alistair doesn't exist. He's just a mask the freak created to hide behind. Well, at least now we should be able to sow a few doubts, assuming we get a chance to speak our piece. Shh.
They both tensed as they heard quiet, furtive footsteps slowly drawing nearer. They rose quickly to their feet, throwing off their tiredness with practiced ease. They'd be tired later, when they had the time. Fisher's hand dropped to her side where her sword should have been.
Oh, damn! We never did get around to finding me a sword.
She reached out and took an oil lamp from its niche in the corridor wall. She shook it and listened to the oil gurgle, unscrewed the lamp into its two parts, and spilled the oil in a wide sweep across the floor. She then threw away the lamp, took a box of matches from her pocket, and held them concealed in her hand.
Good thinking. I've always admired your essentially sneaky and devious nature.
You say the nicest things.
The footsteps grew louder. Hawk slowly drew his sword. He and Fisher stood side by side. Jamie and David appeared around the curve of the corridor and came to a sudden halt as they saw their prey waiting patiently for them. Alistair and Brennan moved quickly in beside Jamie and David. Hawk fixed Jamie with his best authoritative gaze.
Listen to me, Jamie. I'm not the freak, but I know who is.
Kill him! Shut his lying mouth!
The four of them started forward, swords raised.
Listen to me, damn it! I can prove what I'm saying!
Jamie broke into a run, David only a step behind him. Hawk looked at Fisher.
All right, do it.
Fisher struck a match. It flared up on the first try, and she dropped it into the oil. It caught in a second, and flames leapt up to block off the corridor. Hawk and Fisher backed away from the searing heat, and then tensed as a dark figure came hurtling through the flames. It was Alistair. He stood before them, smoke rising from his smoldering clothes, his mouth stretched into a cold and deadly grin. He stepped forward, sword at the ready, and Hawk went to meet him. Sparks flew in the narrow corridor as steel rang on steel, and Hawk knew right away that he was in serious trouble. Alistair was a superior swordsman, and Hawk wasn't anymore. With his axe in his hand, he could probably still have given a good account of himself, but as it was all he could do to defend himself. He backed slowly down the corridor, using every trick he knew to buy himself some breathing space, but Alistair knew them all and their counters. He began to press home his attack, his death's head grin never once faltering. And then Fisher stepped out of the shadows to Alistair's left and kicked him expertly behind the knee. He collapsed and fell forward as pain exploded in his leg. Hawk and Fisher turned and ran down the corridor. Alistair slowly forced himself back onto one knee, paused for breath, and then got to his feet, favoring his aching leg. He'd underestimated Isabel. He wouldn't do that again. He looked back and saw the others gingerly making their way around the edges of the dying flames.
Move along. We have them now.
He gestured impatiently for them to join him and started down the corridor after his prey, trying to ignore the pain in his leg. Farther down the corridor, Hawk stopped suddenly, and Fisher almost ran into him.
What is it, Hawk? Problem?
More like a stroke of luck. I remember this bit of corridor. There's a secret passage here. Somewhere. Jamie showed it to me earlier on.
He pressed hard against a particular piece of stone molding, and a section of the wall swung open. Hawk grinned.
Grab a lamp, Isabel. With any luck, it'll be ages before the others can be sure we're no longer on this floor.
Fisher took a lamp from the wall and lit it, and the two of them plunged into the narrow tunnel. The section of wall closed quietly behind them. In the library, Holly sat staring disconsolately into the fire. The quiet crackling of the flames was the only sound in the room. Arthur had tried to keep her spirits up with his usual dry humor and amusing anecdotes, but he stopped when he realized she wasn't listening and was soon lost in his own thoughts. She couldn't seem to concentrate on anything but the thought that David was in danger and there was nothing she could do to help him.
How could I let Richard take me in so easily? He took us all in. I should have sensed something was wrong about him, but I didn't. Goodness, I actually found him rather likable in an unpolished sort of way.
The thought depressed her, and she looked listlessly around the room, searching for something her eyes could settle on that wouldn't require her to think or feel anything in particular. Arthur sat next to her, his eyelids drooping, a glass of something, as always, in his hand. He looked half asleep. Either the drink or the strain was getting to him. Sitting next to him, Katrina glared blindly straight ahead, lost in thought, the heavy iron poker still clutched firmly in both hands. Her knuckles showed white from the fierceness of her grip. And Mark sat comfortably in his chair, a little way from the rest of them, staring thoughtfully at nothing. He seemed perfectly relaxed and at ease. Holly looked at him enviously. It seemed to her that she'd never feel relaxed again. The flames leapt up suddenly as a log shifted in the fire, and Arthur studied it out of one eye for a moment, before letting it half close again.
I almost wish I'd gone with the others. At least then I'd have been doing something instead of just waiting and worrying, not knowing what was happening. Maybe it's all over by now. They found Richard and killed him, and everything can get back to normal again. Or maybe Richard killed them all, picking them off one at a time from hiding, and is now on his way back down the stairs to finish the job and silence everyone who can identify him.
Arthur stirred unhappily, but kept his features relaxed and his eyes half closed. He didn't want Holly to see he was worried. She looked scared enough as it was. His hand dropped self-consciously to the sword at his side.
I had the same training as all young quality men, but I've never drawn the blade in anger.
He'd never cared much about his honor, certainly not enough to risk his life in a duel over it.
But it isn't just my life at stake now. There's Holly to think of. She is depending on me and Mark to defend her if things go wrong.
Arthur's mouth tightened.
Probably Mark will turn out to be an expert with a sword and I won't be needed. But if worst comes to worst, and only I am standing between Holly and the freak, I hope I find the courage to do the right thing for once in my life.
Arthur looked across at Mark.
I can't say I ever warmed to the man. Mark holds all the character of a block of wood. He possesses no interests or opinions of his own and absolutely no sense of humor.
It wasn't often Arthur found someone he could feel superior to, and he rather enjoyed the novelty. But there was something about Mark he didn't care for. He was too quiet, too bland, too self-effacing. It just wasn't natural for a man to be that polite. Then Mark raised his head and looked at Holly, and Arthur felt a sudden chill go through him. Mark looked different somehow. He looked... Arthur sat up straight suddenly as the thought hit him. Mark looked hungry. Mark turned his head to look at Arthur and smiled pleasantly.
Something wrong, Arthur?
I don't know.
You look as though you've seen a ghost or something worse. What do you think, Arthur? Have you seen something worse?
Maybe. Maybe I have.
Katrina looked at them both, frowning.
What are you two talking about?
We're talking about me. It's a fascinating subject, really.
Mark rose lithely to his feet and stood with his back to the fire, smiling easily at them all.
Tell me, Arthur, when did you first begin to suspect?
I'm not sure. Maybe earlier on, when when I noticed you never ate anything that was offered to you. And although you always had a glass of wine in your hand, you never drank from it. Drunks notice that kind of thing. You were always too self-controlled, too unaffected by the things happening here.
Ah, yes. Emotions. I never could get the hang of them. Unless you count hunger as an emotion. I'm always hungry.
No.
Holly's eyes widened as she shrank back in her chair.
It can't be. You can't be.
I'm afraid so. And they've all gone off and left the three of you alone with me. We're quite safe in here. No one can get to us. I've seen to that. Or did you never consider that a barricade will serve just as well to keep people in, as well as out?
Katrina glared at him, holding her poker before her.
You come near me, and I'll kill you, you freak!
Such a harsh word. But unfortunately for you, perfectly accurate. I'm afraid I've waited as long as I can, and I really don't care to wait any longer. The others will be busy killing each other by now, so we shouldn't be interrupted.
You don't have to do this. We wouldn't tell anyone about you. Honest.
Oh, I think you would, if you had the chance. But I'm afraid I can't afford to leave any witnesses. So I'll take care of you three first. And then I'll go upstairs and introduce myself to whatever survivors there may be. I couldn't do that before. I wasn't strong enough. And the memories got in the way. But now Graves is mine. The memories are under control. And after I've drained the life and strength out of you as well. When the wards go down tomorrow morning, I shall leave this tower and go down into the city. And I will feed and feed and feed and never be hungry again. I think I'll start with you, Holly. I've always admired you. Like a rose without a thorn. So pretty. So vulnerable. That's why I came to you in the night while you slept and took a little life from you to keep myself going. Your memories drifted through my mind like petals on a breeze, sweet but unsatisfying. Did you dream of me? Perhaps. I'd like to think you did. I've dreamed of someone like you for years, and now you're mine.
He started towards Holly, and Arthur scrambled to his feet. He drew his sword and put himself between her and the freak, hoping he looked more impressive than he felt.
Get away from her, you bastard! I won't let you hurt her!
The freak just stood there, smiling.
Very nicely said, Arthur. Now put away your sword and sit down. I'll get around to you when I'm ready.
I mean it!
I'm sure you do. But there's nothing you can do to stop me. As long as I'm within arm's reach of someone, I can drain the life right out of them. Besides, it's obvious from the way you're holding your sword that you don't really know how to use it. Mark knew about things like that, and now so do I. I wonder what I'll know when I've emptied your head, Arthur. How to mix cocktails, perhaps?
Stay back!
Though his voice sounded shaky even to him, at least his sword hand was steady. He'd often dreamed of standing between Holly and some unidentified villain, being the hero of the moment. But now the time had come, and he'd never felt so scared in his life. But he wouldn't back down. Holly needed him. That thought steadied him, and he stepped smartly forward, his sword shooting out in a textbook lunge. Mark sidestepped elegantly and dropped a hand on Arthur's outstretched arm. The sword fell to the floor as his hand went numb. A wave of shuddering cold swept through him as the strength went out of him and into Mark. Arthur fell limply forward, his face striking hard against the floor, but he couldn't feel it. Arthur tried to get to his feet again, but couldn't move. He would have been frightened, but his thoughts were growing too dim even for that. And then Mark's hand was suddenly jerked away from his arm, and his thoughts began to clear. Mark staggered sideways.
There's no visible wound. Oh, but that's just an illusion of Mark. Behind the illusion, he's probably bleeding like a stuck pig.
Then Mark's hand shot out and intercepted the poker, absorbing its momentum with hardly a jolt, though Katrina's hand went numb from the impact. Mark smiled at her, and her eyes rolled up in her head as he sucked the strength out of her. She collapsed in a heap, and Mark let the poker drop to the rug beside her. He turned to face Holly again, and then stopped as Arthur grabbed him by the ankle. Mark tried to pull free and couldn't. Arthur's fingers whitened as he put all his remaining strength into his grip. Holly needed him. Nothing else mattered. Mark bent down and picked up the poker Katrina had dropped. Arthur knew what was going to happen, but he didn't have the strength to turn his head away. He couldn't even shut his eyes. Mark struck down hard with the poker. Arthur's vision disappeared behind a sudden rush of blood. He still wouldn't let go. Holly needed him. Mark continued to hit him.
No! No, no! No!
Holly burst out of her chair and threw herself at Mark, flailing at him with her fists. Mark stumbled backwards and almost fell, but he quickly regained his balance and grabbed one of her waving arms. Holly fell to her knees as the strength went out of her. He smiled down at her.
Don't be so impatient, Holly. I'll be with you in a moment.
He bent down and struck repeatedly at Arthur's hand with the poker. Mark pulled his foot free, threw aside the poker, and turned back to look at Holly.
There. That didn't take too long, did it? Now I'm free to give you my full attention.
He smiled slowly.
You know, Holly, you're what I dreamed of through all the years of being locked away in stone and silence. I watched the light come and go through the narrow slit of window and listened to the seagulls screaming and felt the slow turning of the seasons and dreamed about what I'd do when I finally got out. At first, I dreamed of blood and pain and sweet revenge. And then I dreamed of the world beyond the tower and all the terrible things I would do there. Then I dreamed of women and all the warmth and kindness and beauty I've always longed for and never known, except in dreams. But the years passed and the dreams got mixed up with each other till I really didn't know what I want anymore. I want you, Holly. You're what I dreamed of. So I'm going to hurt you and drain you and hurt you some more. And maybe finally, I'll hurt you till you die. Because I want you so much it hurts me. Come here, Holly. No need to be afraid. After all, I'm just one of the family.
Holly jerked her arm free from his grip and scrambled to her feet, backing away across the room as he came unhurriedly after her. She looked desperately around for help, but Katrina was lying unconscious on the floor, and Arthur was only moving feebly, despite the desperation on his bloody face. Holly wanted to cry, for them and for herself, but there wasn't time. She kept backing away, and Mark kept coming after her, still smiling. She wanted to scream for help, to Jamie or David or one of the others, but she knew they were too far away to hear her. There was no one to help her, so she'd just have to do it herself. She searched for something she could use as a weapon. Maybe a brand from the fire, except that the fireplace was on the other side of the room now, and Mark stood between it and her. There were heavy paperweights on the desk, but Mark intercepted her gaze and moved to block her way. She thought about the door, but she'd never be able to dismantle the barricade before Mark got to her. She felt so safe behind that barricade.
You're a McNeil. Act like one. Think, damn it, think!
She passed by an oil lamp on the wall, and without hesitating, snatched it from its niche and threw it at Mark with all of her strength. She just had time for a brief fantasy of his being consumed by blazing oil, and then Mark's hand shot up and snatched the lamp effortlessly out of midair. He put it gently down on a nearby chair and smiled condescendingly as he circled around her.
Your problem, Holly, is that you keep thinking I'm human. And I'm not. Not really. Why don't I show you what I look like? What I really look like? Would you like that?
Holly tried to say something, but her throat had clamped shut and she couldn't make a sound. She'd somehow ended up by the desk, and her desperate gaze fell upon a slim silver letter opener. She looked quickly away again in case Mark noticed, but his gaze seemed fixed on her. For the first time, he'd stopped smiling. Something stirred in her mind, like suddenly becoming aware of a background noise that had just stopped. Mark seemed to ripple and flow like something far away seen through a heat haze, and then Mark was gone, and the freak stood before her. She'd expected something hideous, some awful misshapen thing with fangs and claws and bulging eyes, but he looked surprisingly ordinary, average height, but very thin and bony, wrapped in clothes too big for him, Mark's clothes. The freak's left arm and leg were severely twisted, and his left shoulder was clearly lower than the other, but none of it was enough to mark him as a freak. Then she looked at his face and didn't know whether to laugh or scream. It was a normal enough face, surrounded by long, greasy hair and a stringy beard, and flecked with blood from a recent scalp wound. But sometime in the past, the mouth had been sewn together. The heavy black stitches sunk deep into the lips, compressing them into a thin white line. Who did it? The father? Before walling the freak up in his cell?
How do you speak?
The mouth twitched in something that might have been meant as a smile.
It's all part of the illusion, my dear. You hear what I want you to hear. But this has gone on long enough, I think. It's time.
He started toward her. She snatched up the letter opener from the desk and thrust it between his ribs. He grabbed both her arms, ignoring the blood coursing down his side. Holly tried to struggle, but all the strength went out of her at his touch. She couldn't even scream as the freak's thin white mouth slowly widened into a grin, the heavy stitches tearing through his lips. And then a section of the library wall swung open, and Hawk and Fisher plunged out into the room. The freak spun around, throwing Holly to one side. Hawk hesitated just long enough to take in the situation and then cut at the freak with his sword. The freak raised his arm at the last moment, and the blade cut into his arm instead of his throat. Hawk danced back out of range as the freak reached for him, blood dripping unheeded from his arm. Fisher circled around to try and get behind him. Holly struggled to get to her feet. Hawk stepped in to cut at the freak again and fell to his knees as every muscle of his body turned to mush. He shook his head sickly, managing somehow to still hang onto his sword, though he no longer had the strength to lift it. The freak reached down and took Hawk's face in his hand. The fingers tightened, and Hawk's cheekbones shifted and creaked under the rising pressure. Fisher snatched a burning brand from the fire and thrust it at the freak's back. The strength went out of her fingers as she came within range. The burning brand fell from her grasp onto the rug before the fireplace. Flames leapt up as the rug caught fire. Holly threw herself at the freak, the sudden weight catching him by surprise and knocking him away from Hawk. The freak landed on his back on the burning rug. The flames leapt up around him as his clothes caught fire. He surged to his feet again, throwing Holly to one side, and lurched back and forth, beating ineffectually at his burning clothes with his hands. There was a puff of blue flame as his hair ignited. Bobby Fisher had some strength back and were on their feet again. Hawk still had his sword, and Fisher snapped up a heavy footstool to use as a club. Holly rose to her feet, ignoring her smoldering clothes, and looked around for something to use as a weapon. The freak turned his back on them and made for the door. He tore apart the barricade, throwing aside the bulky furniture with inhuman strength, and pulled open the door. He staggered out into the corridor, and Hawk and Fisher went after him. The flames were leaping high now, and his skin was beginning to blacken, but still he never made a sound. He glanced back at his pursuers, made for the stairs, and then stopped as he looked up and saw Jamie leading his party down the stairs toward him. The freak looked back and forth, his mutilated mouth twisted in a snarl, and then his power leaped out, driven beyond its usual limits by hate and desperation. One by one, three of those on the stairs slumped to the ground, their eyes slowly closing as the last bit of strength drained from them, until only Alistair remained on his feet. He advanced slowly down the stairs, his face eerily lit by the flames that still leapt around the freak.
It's no use, boy. Your power can't affect me. I'm no more human than you are.
They stood face to face for a moment, staring at each other. Then Alistair's sword shot out and buried itself in the freak's chest. He collapsed to the floor, twitched a few times, and lay still, curled around his death wound. The leaping flames tugged at his clothes, but did not stir him. Alistair pulled out the sword, and then carefully and methodically cut off the freak's head, just in case. One by one, the others rose unsteadily to their feet as strength flowed slowly back into them. Alistair sheathed his sword and went over to Hawk.
I was so sure you were the freak, Richard. It seems I owe you an apology.
Back in the library, the room became a bedlam as everyone talked at once, explaining and apologizing and generally relaxing. Holly fussed around Arthur, wrapping his broken hand in a cloth and trying to clean the blood from his face with a handkerchief soaked in wine. David kept squeezing Arthur's shoulder and telling him incoherently how well he'd done. But finally, Jamie confronted Hawk. Everyone else shut up so they could listen.
All right! Richard, I think you owe us some answers. Granted, we were wrong about you being the freak, and for that, I'm sorry. But you have been behaving very suspiciously. Who are you really, and what are you doing here? And what the hell happened to your eye?
I can't tell you who I am, But I can tell you why I'm here. Isabel and I came here looking for someone.
Who?
Hawk turned and looked at David.
Do you want to tell them, or shall I?
David shrugged and met the McNeil's gaze unflinchingly.
Sorry, Jamie, but I'm afraid I've rather let the side down. I'm a spy. I stumbled across a piece of information I knew Ultramare would pay a hell of a lot for, and the temptation was just too great. I needed the money, you see. I owe a hell of a lot, what with one thing or another. Much more than you ever knew about. And some of my creditors were becoming very insistent. There was even talk of debtor's prison. My family had already made it clear they wouldn't be responsible for my debts anymore. And without their backing, the moneylenders wouldn't even see me. It wasn't difficult making contact with Ultramare. You'd be surprised how many agents they have here in the city. But in the end, it all went wrong, and I ended up running for my life. So I came here, to hide out while I waited for my contact to show up. I had to come anyway to see what Holly was going to get from the will. I was banking on her inheriting a fortune to get me out of the hole I'd dug for myself. She'd have loaned me what I needed. Hell, you'd have given it to me outright, wouldn't you, Holly? You never could deny me anything.
Why the hell didn't you ask me for the money? I wouldn't have let you go under, for the sake of a miserable few thousand ducats.
I couldn't ask you, or any of my friends. I didn't want you to know what a fool I'd made of myself. I have my pride. It's all I've got left now. I won't give it up. I won't stand trial either. Arthur, look after Holly.
David turned and ran out the door and into the corridor. Hawk and Fisher went after him.
Everyone else, stay here!
Hawk and Fisher charged down the corridor and up the stairs in pursuit of David Brooke. They were both tired after their struggle with the freak, and David soon outdistanced them. They pressed on, following the sound of his feet on the stairs. They passed the second floor and the third, and still David led them on.
Where the hell does he think he's going? There's nowhere left now but the battlements. And once he's there, we've got him cornered.
Not necessarily. There's still one way down if he wants to take it.
They finally burst out into the morning air and found David sitting on the edge of the far parapet wall, waiting for them. Fisher started forward, but Hawk put a restraining hand on her arm. The sunlight was almost painfully bright after the gloom of the third floor, and Hawk stood quietly a moment, letting his eye adjust. David sat patiently, his legs dangling over the long drop. He was smiling slightly.
Come away from the edge! It's dangerous!
Look at the view! Isn't it marvelous? It feels like you can see forever.
Is that why you dragged us all the way up here? To admire the view?
David shrugged and smiled.
I won't ask you how I gave myself away. It doesn't matter. I was pretty much an amateur at the spying game anyway. But I would like to know who you really are.
Hawk and Fisher, captains in the Haven City Guard. We're the ones who chased you through half of the city last night.
David raised an eyebrow.
I'm impressed. I've heard some of the stories they tell about you two. Are they true?
Some of them.
What did you do with the Sorcerer Grimm?
We killed him.
Good. I wouldn't have dealt with him at all if my contact hadn't insisted.
Who was your contact?
It was always someone different. They didn't trust me enough to let me see anyone important.
What about the information? What was so important that so many people had to risk their lives because of it?
David stared out across the sea.
The monarch of Ultramare is coming here to Haven to meet with our king and hammer out a peace treaty to put an end to the border clashes before they start really getting out of hand. But there are those on both sides who would profit greatly from a war. People who don't want the peace talks to succeed. Knowing the exact date and time and place of those talks was therefore of very great value to those with an interest in sabotaging them. And I knew. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and nosy enough to look at a sheet of paper left lying carelessly on a desk. That's how it all started. As simply as that.
Come away from the edge. You might fall.
I'm not going back. If I were put on trial, it would disgrace my family's name. I can't do that. I've been enough of a disappointment to them as it is. Besides, my friends would be found guilty by association just for knowing me. Holly would be hounded, ostracized because she was close to me. I can't have that. I think Holly could be happy with Arthur, don't you?
Yes. He cares for her.
Good. Wish them well.
David pushed himself out and away from the wall, and he was gone. He didn't utter a sound, and by the time Hawk and Fisher reached the edge, he had fallen all the way down to the rocks at the bottom of the cliffs. The wards finally went down at 10 o'clock in the morning. A subtle vibration came and went on the air, and the solid weight of Tower MacNeil seemed to settle itself more comfortably. As suddenly and simply as that, it was over. Hawk ceremoniously opened the front door, and he and Fisher stepped out into the brisk morning air. It was a fine sunny morning, with only the cold nip of the wind to remind them of how close winter was. Gulls rode the wind on outstretched wings, crying and keening, and from far below came the endless crash of waves on the rocks. Only Jamie and Robbie Brennan were there to say goodbye, and Hawk and Fisher were just as happy that way. It had been an uncomfortable time for all of them, waiting for the wards to go down. Hawk and Fisher might have saved the day, but their very presence was a reminder of things the MacNeils were eager to forget. The four of them stood together a moment, two within the tower and two without, none of them sure what to say for the best. They all looked at him expectantly.
You've done my family a great service. The freak is finally at rest, and the MacNeils are free of their curse, if not their shame. I wish you'd let me reward you in some way. Just saying thanks doesn't seem nearly enough.
Thanks are all we want. I'm just grateful you haven't insisted on knowing who we really are.
I have a strong feeling I should.
Jamie tried not to stare at Hawk's closed right eye.
But I'm equally sure I wouldn't like the answer. You'd probably only lie anyway.
Hawk and Fisher grinned and said nothing.
I'm afraid we're all the send-off you're going to get. The others have all managed to be very busy just at the moment. Holly and Lord Arthur are comforting each other as best they can. For the moment, they both miss David too much to think of anything else, but I wouldn't be surprised if they ended up staying together. I think they'd be good for each other. Who knows? Maybe she'll even stop him from drinking.
It's possible, I suppose. Stranger things have happened.
Aunt Katrina's upstairs packing. I told her she was still welcome to stay as long as she wished, but it would appear she can't wait to leave. She says she doesn't feel safe here anymore. I can understand that. I've lived all my life in the tower, and I don't feel the same way about it now. It's as though an old and trusted friend suddenly revealed a dark and violent side to his nature. Something you'd never even suspected before. I'll probably get over it, but I don't think I'll ever really trust the tower again.
Where's she going?
Back to the city. I don't think she herself knows where she's going yet.
Maybe she'll go back to her husband.
I hope not. For his sake. I wouldn't wish Katrina on my worst enemy. Well, at least not until I was in a really nasty mood.
What about Alistair? He spent most of yesterday evening trying to avoid us.
He's around here, somewhere, hiding his face. I think he still feels guilty about accusing you of being the freak. No doubt he'll turn up again once you're safely gone.
There was another pause as they ran out of polite, unimportant things to say.
I'm sorry about David. He wasn't a bad sort. We would have taken him alive if we could.
I know that. I've no doubt it happened just the way you described. David was many things, but he was never a coward. He knew there was only one thing he could do to protect his family, and he did it. I don't know what I'm going to tell them. Some of the truth is bound to come out eventually. I can't even bring his body home to them. The tides have already taken it out to sea. I feel guilty about him, you know. I was his friend. I should have realized something was wrong. If I had, maybe I could have found a way to help him before he got mixed up with the wrong people.
Stop that. If David had wanted you to know, he would have told you. He had enough opportunities. But his pride wouldn't let him. Perhaps he just didn't want to drag his friends down with him. Whatever happened is his responsibility. No one else's. You're the MacNeil now, Jamie. You must learn not to worry about things that can't be changed.
Jamie nodded slowly, but still looked unconvinced. Hawk decided this might be a good time to change the subject.
What about you, Robbie? What are you going to do with yourself now that Duncan's left you such a sizable windfall?
Damned if I know, to be honest. But I might just do a little traveling. It's a long time since I was out in the world. There's bound to have been a lot of changes, and I think I'd like to see some of them while I still can. Not that I haven't been happy here, Jamie. but it's not the same with Duncan gone. I look back from time to time, see how you're getting on. Sing you any new songs I've picked up.
Yes, of course. That would be nice.
You're not fooling anyone, Jamie. You never did appreciate my singing.
It's an acquired taste. And I've only been listening to you for about 20 years.
They all smiled genuinely, and Hawk put his hand out to Jamie. The McNeil shook it firmly. There was a quick burst of handshaking all around, and Hawk led Fisher away before the goodbyes could become awkward again. They set off down the trail that led to the city, and didn't look back.
Well, how did you like being one of the quality, Isabel?
The food was good and the wines were splendid, but the company sucked. And I hate their idea of fashion. God! Of course it pinches me every time I breathe. Having my hair piled up like this makes my head ache, and these shoes are killing me.
Just be grateful we don't have to mix with a dozen or more families in high society.
I am grateful. Believe me.
I don't think we did too badly. We didn't hit anyone.
Fisher shook her head.
You don't have the right attitude for high society, Hawk.
Look who's talking.
They made their way back down toward Haven. Alistair stood alone in the drawing room, looking up at the portrait of the family guardian hanging over the fireplace. The room stood very quiet, the only sound the soft crackling of the fire. He knew he didn't have much time before the others would come looking for him, but still he hesitated, torn with indecision. It was such a long time since he'd last walked the corridors of the tower.
I didn't know. I've missed it so much.
He looked around the drawing room, deliberately not hurrying himself, taking in all the details. They'd made a lot of changes since his day. He didn't care for most of them, but then fashions change. He walked slowly around the room, smelling the flowers and admiring the paintings and tapestries and letting his fingers drift over the polished surfaces of the furniture. He couldn't stay. It was his home, but he couldn't stay. He didn't belong here anymore. The young girl Holly had begged for him to come, and so he did. But he wasn't needed anymore. The freak was dead at last, finally at peace. He turned back to face the portrait again. It was time to go before the others realized he wasn't really Alistair McNeil after all. He wanted so much to stay, to walk in the real world, to see the sun rise and fall and feel the wind on his face. But he still had his penance to fulfill. The penance he'd taken on so many years ago for the terrible things he'd done to his son, the freak. The McNeil family guardian held his head high and disappeared back into the portrait hanging over the fireplace, waiting to be called again whenever they might need him. Hawk and Fisher, Wolf in the Fold is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1991, Simon R. Green, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Danny Gavigan, Ren Casey, Joe Brack, Christopher Sheeran, Dylan Lynch, Richard Rowan, Andy Clements, Catherine Aselford, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, Scott McCormick, Nanette Savard, Yasmin Toison, Ken Jackson, Jeff Allen, Colleen Delaney, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Hawk and Fisher, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth series, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
am I dead? Is this it? Am I dead?
Go back.
Elbryon?
Go back.
Elbryon. Oh, oh, my love. I'm so weary.
You cannot be here. Not now. You cannot forsake our son when his hour of need approaches.
Elbryon, do not chase me away. Adrian is beyond me, beyond all the world.
Go back!
St. Mirabel has never fallen, not to any enemy. Not to the great powry fleet that attacked us in the time of the demon. Not to the goblin hordes that descended upon the civilized lands. Not to the errant judgments of Father Abbot Delibert Markwort. Not to the plague in all its incarnations. Our walls are strong, though not nearly as strong as the faith that truly holds us firm.
Fine words, brother. We will speak them together and loudly for all to hear. When King Adrian comes knocking.
Dragon, the second oldest of the races and the most vile by far.
You knew that Bryn Dariel was rumored to possess such a beast.
So?
So explain your reaction.
I cannot explain. The revulsion within me, I had not anticipated.
Were you not joking earlier that you would desire such a beast as a mount?
I would desire its vile head as a trophy and nothing more.
We have been deceived. Duke Calus has turned.
How is this possible? Why did your scouts not detect?
Adrian and his gemstones.
We cannot fight them all.
If we turn now, St. Mirabel is doomed.
St. Mirabel is doomed in any case.
We have nowhere to run.
Then let us fight.
And so it ends.
Don't miss the final confrontation between good and evil. The conclusion of The Demon War Saga, Book 7, Immortalis, Part 3. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.